On this episode of the People Stack podcast, Rob and I interviewed Josh Duty. Josh is a salary negotiation coach specializing in helping high earners get paid what they're worth. So if you've been following us for a while, that name might sound familiar to you. So we did have Josh on the podcast way back in 2018. He was episode 45. His interview was episode 45 of the People Stack podcast. It's been 5 years and we all were like, oh my God, it's been so long. How could it have been so long? So we figured it was time to have him back. And we had a fabulous conversation, of course, about salary negotiation. We had a lively discussion, really kind of dug deep and geeked out about pay bands and what pay bands are. And Josh shared his views on pay bands and how to work through them in the negotiation process. We talked about some of the recent laws that have been passed around banning revealing salary history. So there's been a number of states at this point who have basically made it illegal for companies to ask, what have you gotten paid in the past? And so Josh gave his thoughts about that, his nuanced approach, his professional approach to that, as well as revealing any, as well as his approach to and thoughts on what he calls the dreaded salary question, which is essentially, hey, what's ballpark? What do you want to make? So he goes into that. And all of these, by the way, are in his book. His book is Fearless Salary Negotiation. We highly recommend that. And we talked about salary transparency, his views, again, very nuanced about salary transparency. Again, companies being more transparent. Here's the pay band that we're going to offer. They might have it in the job ad, or the recruiter might reveal it as you start the interview process. So we talked a lot about salary negotiation. You're going to learn a ton about that from an expert. He does this as his job. So often when people ask him, he's like, oh, wow, this is what you do full time? Yep, I do this full time. This is my job. I have my own business as a salary negotiation coach. So he also goes into that. So Josh talks about how he became a self-employed salary negotiation coach and his career path, his career trajectory toward that. He considers this to be his dream career, and he talks about why, and he talks about how he believes he was able to create this dream career for himself. We also talk about his money beliefs and what he believes financial freedom is. So this is a juicy episode. It gets a little bit spicy because anytime we're talking about money, it is going to get a little bit spicy. So, you know, really lean back, soak it up, and enjoy this valuable and informative episode that's, yes, about dream careers, and that is also about fearless salary negotiation. Enjoy. Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Funk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the People Stack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the People Stack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the 4 strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Hello, Josh. It is so great to have you here. We're really excited about this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, y'all. It's been a few years, I think, since we talked. So I'm excited to check in and see how you're doing and just talk about whatever we had to talk about today. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think so too. So Josh is a salary negotiation coach, and he specializes in helping high earners get paid what they're worth. So we want to know all about all that you're willing to divulge about how you became a salary negotiation coach, because I think that's probably going to be one of the things that are like, it's on people's minds. Like, oh, you mean you can make a living as a salary negotiation coach? That's really cool. So we'd love you to talk about that. And then also if you could specify and define what you mean by high earners, because people may have different definitions of that.
Sure. I'll work backwards on those so I don't forget the second part. So high earners are people who are making a total comp of around $400,000 a year or more. I say total comp because there's a lot of different ways that job offers and comp packages are structured. So it's easier just to talk about total comp. So yeah, high earner is somebody who's making around $400,000 a year or more. Jumping backwards. So how did I become a salary negotiation coach? Yeah, it's funny you asked that, and even the way that you kind of described it was interesting, because usually when I'm talking to somebody casually, like I play a lot of pickleball. So you talk to people and you have a new partner in pickleball and they'll say, oh, what do you do? And then I kind of always, I've been doing this for years and I still kind of pause and I'm like, all right, you know, like, are they ready for this? I tell them I'm a salary negotiation coach for high earners to help them get paid what they're worth. And then they kind of look at me and they go, so do you do that for yourself, or you work for? And I was like, no, it's just me, you know? And then like I say, yeah, I kind of basically created this thing that I do several years ago. So how did I do that several years ago? I started my career as an engineer. So this story is going to, I think, be interesting to y'all, because the name of your business is the People Stack. And I don't think we've ever talked in depth about where you got People Stack, but I have some ideas. And I think I'm a great example of skill stacking, or however you want to phrase that, to end up with this kind of weird combination of skills that I accumulated over years that I decided to do an unusual thing with. So I started as an engineer. I studied computer and electrical engineering as an undergrad. I went to work as an electrical engineer right out of school. Very quickly, I got simultaneously sort of disillusioned and bored. I was working for a very big Department of Defense firm here in the US, and was very ambitious and just wanted to see kind of how quickly I could skyrocket my career, get promotions, get raises, move into management and all that good stuff. So I was working really hard. I was getting those raises and promotions. And then one day my manager kind of pulled me aside and he sat me down. And to his credit, I think he thought he was giving me a pep talk. And in fact, he was not. But he said, hey, you know, I just want to tell you, like, you know, he drew a little graph on the board of like, you know, income over time, you know, and he said, you know, you're up here right now. He started drawing kind of like a little scatter plot, a little dot that's like, a you know, and you're here and then you're here. He said, but I just want you to know that, like, over the course of your career here, which is going to be 25 or 30 years, you're going to look like this. And he just drew a straight line from the bottom left to the top right. And so what he was telling me was eventually you're going to regress to the mean, because everyone does at this company. And I think what he was trying to do was calm me down and kind of give me a sense of like, it's okay, just calm down, take it easy, man, just enjoy the ride. But what I heard was, this isn't a meritocracy. It doesn't matter what you do or how hard you work or how smart you are. You're going to end up on this line eventually. And immediately I was like, well, I guess I'm out of here. Like within 6 weeks I was gone. So, like I said, I think he was trying to do a good thing, and he did do a good thing, just not the good thing that he thought he was going to do, which is he helped me understand that that was not a good environment for me to thrive. So I left, and I moved to a small software company where, there was an opportunity for me to work in client services and be customer facing and help sort of drive business results for our customers, do some business analysis, do some project management and all that good stuff. And so totally different than, you know, kind of back office electrical engineering stuff that I was doing. And that company happened to be an HR technology company that was selling what is now called talent management software. Back then, that industry didn't exist. And so they were selling software to do goal planning and succession planning and career planning and compensation planning. And so I was consulting with our customers on how to use our software to plan compensation and to pay people, including equity splits and all this great stuff. And so that was my first kind of, you know, peek behind the curtain on how all that looked. And then eventually I became a project manager and then kind of led a small team doing tech projects. And all along the way, I'm doing this consulting, but also started negotiating my own salary because I didn't. The first couple of jobs I took, you know, what they offered and then took actually a slight pay cut and then took another slight pay cut, which was fine. And I think there are times in a career to do that. But eventually I had an MBA and was starting to really kind of build some collateral that I could use to add value, and thought, shouldn't I just not accept the, like, what happens if I ask for more money than they're offering me? What, you know, I was just curious. Basically, I hadn't read about it or heard anybody else do it. I just thought I'd try it, and it worked. I got more money. I was like, well, that was a lot easier than I thought it would be. It was like one conversation with a recruiter. So I did it again next time I changed jobs, and I got more money. And then the last day job that I had, was managing a small team. I built scripts and things that I still use to this day to coach people, and negotiated my own salary. And I have a vivid memory of me with like a script written on my whiteboard in my little office that I rented, where I'm having the call with the recruiter and they say something and I go to my script and I started to respond and was going to say the wrong thing in response. And my script stopped me. I said, no, actually, if you can do this, then I'm on board. And they said, okay, we'll see what we can do. And they gave it to me. And I was like, wow, this like works, you know? So during that day job, I started writing a book, as a passion project. I just thought it was fun. People would ask me about it because they would hear every now and then that I had negotiated my salary or I made weird career choices and that kind of thing. And so I thought, you know, I'm interested in this. I'd like to write. I'd already written a book by that time. So I was like, I'll just write a book about this so that everybody has it. So I wrote Fearless Salary Negotiation, and then published the book. And then to finally get to the answer to your question, how did I become a salary negotiation coach? The answer is, people asked me to become their salary negotiation coach. So I had my first client ever reached out to me. I had coached her husband while I was writing my book because I needed, you know, case studies basically to prove out my methodology, because I built a methodology from scratch. It was meant to be a one size fits all methodology that would help anyone negotiate a job offer. It was super hard to do. And so I needed some test cases to make sure this thing worked. And so I coached him through it. He got a good result. And like a year and a half later, his wife reached out and said, hey, you coached my husband through this. I wonder if you could coach me through it. I just got a job offer. She was a freelance copywriter at the time and had gotten a full-time offer. I said, sure. So she asked me what my rate was. And I said, well, whatever your rate is, that's my rate. And so she told me her hourly rate as a writer. And I just charged her that. We got her a good result. And afterwards I said, hey, like, you had my book. I coached your husband through this. He knows how this works. He could probably do it. Why did you ask me if you could hire me? And she said, I just wanted you to tell me exactly what to do. And yeah. Then like a light bulb went off. Right. And so I said, aha. And then somebody else asked me again a couple months later. And then eventually I said, you know what? I should focus on actually doing this full time. And so I kind of put out my shingle as a salary negotiation coach and started telling people about it and then was off to the races. So that's a long answer to your question, but that's my history of how I got to be a salary negotiation coach.
I love it. I love the long answer. I love the nuanced approach to it. It wasn't that I was just, you know, born to be a salary negotiation coach, right? Like how many kids are like, hey, when I grow up, right?
No.
Not that it's a bad thing, but it just may not be something that occurs to you. And you just kept, what I hear is you kept following what was fun to you, what you felt like you were good at, and what you felt like there was a need for. And so it's like the combination of those three things that we talk about with our clients all the time. Like, how do you find that sweet spot? You were just kind of leaning into that, like, hey, this is kind of fun and I'm good at it and it works. Okay. Holy cow. This is great. And so did that first client. So the first client came because of the husband-wife referral. And then subsequent clients, they came through the book. They found out about you from the book and then maybe website and things like that.
Yeah. My second client came to me. She was a friend from middle school. And, you know, so obviously it had been decades since I talked to her, but we were friends on Facebook and she had seen me promoting my book. And so she reached out and she's like, hey, I see that you do the salary stuff. Can you help me? And she told me about her and I said, yeah, I can help. And so she hired me. And then after that, it was, you know, people would tell people about me. I worked really hard on SEO early in the business, which turned out to be great. So I was also doing, you know, I would do talks at coding boot camps and code schools and universities and that kind of thing. So I went up to Georgia Tech one weekend and I went down to Orlando for a coding boot camp and that kind of stuff. And so I kind of started getting word of mouth out that way. And so people would reach out to me kind of one-on-one or off, you know, off the cuff. And then eventually the SEO engine that I built kind of took over, which was initially meant to build to sell books, but it turned out that it was also great at attracting people who were searching for help actually negotiating their own job offers. And those were mostly tech people, because my market for several years was very focused on like tech and big tech and software engineers who are, you know, very, you know, sort of tech savvy, Google savvy. They're searching for help on stuff all the time. So it grew from people who just kind of saw what I was doing and said, can you help me, to strangers who started finding me. I wish I could remember the first stranger I ever coached. I'll go back, I think, later and figure out who that was. But yeah, people would reach out and say, hey, you know, I see you do this. Can you help me? And then eventually I made like a formal offering and have been working, you know, tweaking it basically for several years now.
Awesome. So there's a couple of things that I wanted to share, a question for you. But before that, what I wanted to share is, like, I can vouch, both Rob and I can vouch for the validity, I guess would be the better word. In other words, Josh's stuff works. So we have had a longstanding partnership with Josh where we essentially gift our clients the sort of it's the book plus a whole bunch of other fun Josh Judy goodies, which includes that script that you were talking about that you used. And we've, with the help of those resources and of that structure, we've helped many of our clients to get paid what they're worth, where if they didn't negotiate, it would have left, it's like tens of thousands and like collectively hundreds of thousands, potentially collectively millions of dollars on the table if you add it all together. So we can personally vouch for it. Yeah, it works. And what's nice about it, like I highly recommend if anybody is even just curious about salary negotiation and how it works and what's a system for it, I highly recommend Josh's book. It's a quick read, which I like because it's like, oh man, I don't want to have to read 2,000 pages to figure this out, right? It's like, nope. It's very efficient. It's like, oh wow, this is the way that it works. And it's like, it's so intuitive as well. And I love the fearless part of it. It's like, here's your permission slip, just do it. Right? Yep. Like this is the way. It's almost that validation of, because so many of us don't have the insight into what happens in other salary negotiations except ours. And so just to hear it from you saying, yeah, this is the way that it's going to work, I can basically tell you at a very high level how these conversations are going to go. So that's just like, you know, that's what makes it fearless. So anyway, what I wanted to ask about was, it sounds like you started out fairly general in terms of who you helped, and then you kind of defined your niche. So tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, that's been a really interesting journey. And I think a big part of the business overall. I started, you know, the book is written, like I said earlier, it's intentionally sort of a one size fits all. How do you negotiate a job offer that could be done for, I mean, literally somebody getting a job offer for like an hourly service worker type job up to, I mean, executives all the time tell me that they read my book and they use the methodology. It was meant to be, when I wrote it, kind of general. And I think a lot of that was because, again, it was just a passion project. And I wasn't thinking like, can I write this for a niche that will be really profitable? I was just thinking like, how do I write this in a way that can get the thing out there and can be useful for people? And so it was, you know, the examples in the book were like a project manager. And I think there was a software engineer in there, and it was kind of all over the map intentionally. And then my first client was a freelance copywriter. My second client was like an administrator at a hospital. And then when I started kind of finding people to give talks to, basically, right? So I'm early on, I'm trying to get the book out there and trying to launch it on Amazon to number one and categories and all that stuff. And so I started giving talks. And I found that the talks that I gave for software engineers were received really well. And that the results they got from using my methodology were also sort of outsized relative to some of the other folks that I'd worked with. And so, you know, it wasn't initially an intentional decision, but I just sort of ended up talking to them more and more because, you know, if I give a talk at a coding bootcamp, somebody hears it and they tell somebody else about it and they want me to give a talk at their coding bootcamp. And there was a local coding bootcamp. And so it just sort of like, I talked to all different types of people, you know, the Rotary Club, you know, local Rotary Club and that kind of thing, but it just always ended up coming back to software engineering. And so for many years it was, you know, software engineers. And then as you know, I basically became overwhelmed. I said, I need to kind of narrow this niche down. So I'll go senior software engineers and then senior software engineers and engineering managers. And I kind of kept walking up the hierarchy and then focused on big tech instead of just general. Because again, the results that people were getting were much bigger at the big tech companies at the time. And then eventually now I'm working with high earners, which essentially I was looking at the software engineers and engineering managers and some directors at big tech companies. Then I was like, what's the commonality here? And I was like, well, the commonality is that basically I have a skill set that is going to produce a sort of, let's call it like a marginal return, a percentage return that looks pretty similar. It's going to be 10 to 20%, sometimes more, sometimes it's 50% or sometimes 100%, but you know, 10 to 20% of $50,000 is a lot less than 10 to 20% of $500,000 in a nominal sense. And so basically like I can kind of swing my hammer and hit a lot of different nails, but the nails that are high earners are the ones that produce the biggest results. I've never used that analogy before. I probably will never use it again. So we'll put a star next to that. That's how it worked. And so
as a fellow business owner. Yeah.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, it's, you know, I'm very agnostic on sort of what the right way to run a business is, or what the right niche is, or what the right market is. I look at my business and see what it's telling me. and I look around and I see what the kind of the universe is telling me about the direction of my business and what's working, what's not working. And I will not continue to sort of run into that wall if it's not working. And if there's a door that's open, I'm going to sprint through the door and see what's on the other side and look for other doors. So So over time, it was an organically slowly morphing target market that I worked with that got, you know, to that really long software engineers, engineering managers of big tech companies, and now has gone back to a shorter high earners because I realized, you know, I really it doesn't matter to me if you're a software engineer or like a VP of marketing at a Fortune 5 company. You both have the same problem in hand and I can help you both. And so I will work with you both instead of, you know, limiting myself.
Yeah, got it.
And just to add some extra frosting on top of that really tasty cake. When Jen and I have been working with individuals and particularly marginalized individuals, folks who have been pushed to the sideline or have been undervalued, the combination of our skill set along with your methods has had astronomical impact. One example I'm thinking of was triple what that person was making before. And that was the prior salary that they had, they were proud of. They felt lucky to get. And then the new role fits them so much better. And they, when they were made their initial offer, the initial offer blew their mind. We then used your stuff on top of that. And then it went up another $70,000-$80,000.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah.
So that person's no longer marginalized, no longer on the sideline. And the confidence boost that alone gave them, like, they're not there about the money. But it's nice to know, number one, you're loved. Number two, when you ask the company for something, they're going to go to bat for you. And number three, your manager believes enough in you that they're going to take this flyer on you. So that's awesome. And so it's excellent to get to have you back on the show again, because we just love you so much, Josh.
Well, I mean, that story is awesome. It sounds so weird to say, but I mean, that's why I do what I do, right? Like I've talked to people in the past. So like I'm 43. So like the career trajectory I was on, like by now I would be, you know, my job title would be director, senior director, maybe VP at a smaller company. I would be on my way to, if I wanted to be like a CEO or so, I'd be, you know, on the executive track. But I've chosen not to do that. And part of that is sort of personal preferences with agency over my time and my sort of a life. But part of it is also that I really just like what I do. And you know, I thought the Mega Millions is like up to $1 billion right now or something. So I have some friends that we always buy a couple of tickets when Mega Millions gets big, because I'm not playing like 100 million, I'm not interested, but $1 billion, you know, anyway. So they're like, you want a couple of tickets? I was like, yeah. And I was thinking, like, what would I do if I won the Mega Millions? And the answer is probably just keep doing this. But also not have to worry about, you know, finances, you know what I mean? And that's an interesting sort of epiphany for me. I've had a few of those in my career, but that's one where it's like, I don't think I would stop doing this, just because I like that last email that I get from a client, and, you know, we're both sweating it, wonder what happened. And they're like, I got another $60,000 a year. Thank you. And I'm like, yes, you know, and we breathe a sigh of relief, and it just feels good, because that person would not have, like you said, they wouldn't have known how to do that on their own. And so it's really cool to kind of give people those tools for something that, you know, I started asking and on the feedback form after we worked together for my clients a few years ago, I started asking, like, what does this mean to you? Because I'm very interested in, like, because most people, you know, it's easy to think that people just want more money because they want a bigger bank account. But usually it's something like, well, now I can confidently know that I'll pay for my kids' college when it's time, right? Or we can finally upgrade our house, or we're going to be able to go on to that vacation that we've been putting off for a couple of years to Italy. And it's like, that's a real tangible outcome for people that isn't just about a bigger number in a bank account. It's about a thing that they can do now, or a way that they can live their life that they couldn't before. And all I have helped them do is to capture the value they have already created. So that's the fun thing for me, is I'm not creating the value. I'm helping them capture the value that they have created. They did that work. So it's super, super gratifying. I know y'all feel the same way about the work that you do with people, but man, it's a good feeling to get to the end of an engagement and be like, Yeah, that's a material change in their life. They are going to have a different life today, but also 10 years from now, like there's a compounding effect to how much better it's going to be for them in 10 years.
One of my favorite instances of somebody who we were able to help through a negotiation, again, using your methods, Josh, this person was negotiating the swing from contract to hire within the same organization. They were a known quantity. Mm-hmm. The offer came in, but the big issue for this person wasn't necessarily the money. It was the commute between where they lived and where they were working went through a major metropolitan area to the opposite side suburb.
Oof.
And through those methods, they were able to negotiate full-time work from home before the pandemic, when that was a thing that was really, really suspect and hard. Because as they were going through the steps, they were able to identify that ability to work from home, to not have to lose 2 hours of commuting or more a day, and the ability to be able to rush and pick up at daycare if needed, was far more important to them than another 10, 15%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because they followed the process, they got the 10, 15% and full-time work remote. But yeah, it's great that we're also, you've got the carve outs in there for people to really focus in on what is important to them, so that through the negotiation process, they come out with an agreement and understanding that this is what it's going to be like to work with me, and this is what it's going to be like for me to work with you.
Yep.
And yep, boom, there it is. And you get to move on and really kick ass, take names, and know that the company values you such that these are my requirements, and they say, yes, done.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. You just reminded me of a couple of years ago, I worked with somebody. He was a friend of mine, actually, but he is in the same situation. He was going contract to full-time at a company that he'd been at for a few years. And part of my initial discussion with people is basically like, what matters most to you, right? Because the easy thing for me to do is assume that you want more cash, you want more base salary or equity or whatever. He was like, you know, honestly, you know, I've been a contractor, which means I've managed my own schedule, and now I'm going to go work full-time, which is fine. He was looking forward to it, but he's like, you know, I'm going to really miss on Fridays. I get to pick my kids up for school. We start the weekend early, we do stuff. And he was like, if I could have Fridays free, that is actually more important to me than more money. And so I said, well, I mean, if we model this out, you know, we would ask for 10 to 20% more in your case. So let's say we were going to ask for 20% more money. That's basically an extra day of pay. So what if instead of that extra day being cash in your bank account, it was an extra day of the week that you got? And so we negotiated down from a 5-day work week to a 4-day work week, and he had Friday off. So he got the same comp they offered him, but we managed to negotiate Monday to Thursday work week, and he had Friday to spend, you know, picking up his kid at school and doing things with them. So, and again, it's like, I never would have thought of that because, you know, it's easy just to look at dollars, but for him, that was a huge quality of life improvement. In the same way, you know, I used to have a commute when I lived in Dallas, you know, driving through a major metro area to get to work and back every day is, it's a nightmare. I mean, it's just soul sucking. It feels awful. And so that's a really cool outcome where they could do the same job, but do it from home and save all of that commute time, which is just basically just wasted time. I mean, you can listen to as many audiobooks as you want, but the bottom line is you're sitting in a car for 4 hours a day or 2 hours a day or whatever. That's really cool. That's a great story. I love that story.
Yeah. And what's actually even more interesting about that story, if this is, I don't know if it's the same one that you were thinking of, Rob, but I know that there was one where he didn't actually ask for full-time work remote. I think it was some percentage for something like that. Cause we're like, let's give them some wiggle room here. And so we were helping him come up with the language for like what percentage of work remote or something like that, like 3 days a week, four days a week, I work from the office and 1 day a week I work from home or something like that. And then when it came down to the actually signing the contract, the language in the contract was very clear. It's just your full-time work remote. It's like, hey,
okay,
cool. Because it was just too wonky to come up with the language and to have to track or whatever. It's like, you know what? We're just going to give you carte blanche. It's just easier for us. It's easier for you. Why don't we just give you everything? Right. And then I think he even said he would still go into the office from time to time because he liked the social aspect of it. But just knowing that he can, if he wanted to, work from home every single day, it's win-win-win for everyone. So I love those kinds of stories where it's about what do you want? what's most important to you? What are your priorities? So that's really fun.
Yeah. I know that you, I'm sure you talk about that with your clients a lot too, right? Like it's important for me as a coach or consultant or however you want to model what I do to understand like what the actual outcomes are that are meaningful to my clients and not that I kind of impose those meaningful outcomes on them, because most of the time I'll be able to guess or I'll know, but sometimes you just don't know. And there might, that conversation is part of like the organic process of working with people that I really enjoy, which is I will uncover things and I'll say, you know, what if we ask for this? And they'll go, I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. And it's something that I just kind of pick up talking to them that isn't as simple as like, let's just ask for more cash. Sometimes there's something that's actually more valuable than cash. So that's cool.
Yeah.
And I think right there, you've hit the nail on the head as to why just possession of your book or possession of podcast interviews with you that go over aspects of the method aren't sufficient. I mean, especially in the software engineering community, we're used to accumulating tens of thousands of books that teach us how to do X, Y, Z, and what have you. And many of those things are on careers. They're on how to execute your career, how to move from this point to this point, what have you. And there's so many differing opinions that you just want to, at the end of the day, work with me, help me to find the thing that's best for me and allow me to move forward in my way using your toys. And so congratulations, you have a career.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I have anything to add to what you just said, but yeah, I think you're dead on there. It's a matter of uncovering the things that are meaningful. And that's, like I said, I mean, the book is written to be sort of one size fits all, but inevitably in every conversation that I have with somebody, one or two things will jump out at me and I'll say, aha, and I'll kind of write them down and I'll come back to those. And those will be things that we can really grab onto, either that are things that are important to them or we can focus on, or things that I hear them say that they don't even realize are important, but that are going to be meaningful for our negotiations. Like the thing that you just said that your hiring manager said to you, that's unusual. And we're going to grab onto that. And we're going to use that as an opportunity to improve your comp or whatever we're going to focus on.
Yeah. What I'm curious about, and it's interesting, probably the different experiences that we have in helping our clients negotiate, because they're hiring you as a negotiation coach. Like they know they're going to be negotiating, even if there's some fear, versus working with us. It's like they kind of know, like in the back of their mind, when I get a job offer, Jen and Rob are going to help you negotiate with this system. So I'm curious, we've had a number of clients. So not all of the clients that we work with require salary negotiation help, because for a lot of them, it's not about that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So you, I know, have way more experience in terms of numbers, in terms of helping people with this. So I'm curious about this, but we've had a number of clients where the way that I kind of taught label it, and I think that they would label it this way too, because they've said it, is basically we've talked them off the ledge. So what this looks like is it's getting real. They get the offer and then it's like, oh shit, I can't negotiate, because there's this fear of them reneging. There's this fear of them like being seen as a jerk or a money grubbing slime ball or whatever it is. So I'm curious, even with you, they're hiring you as a salary negotiation coach. Have you experienced that kind of a thing?
I have. So there are kind of two approaches that I can think of to answer this question. And one of them comes from sort of like the way that I've structured my business, that angle. And the other one is sort of the psychological side of it and the way that I negotiate. So the first one is my fee structure is set up specifically to help people avoid getting cold feet. So briefly, I have a service fee. That's an upfront fee that you pay to work with me. It's not a retainer, but the easiest way to describe it is as a retainer. Basically, you're paying me to work with me. That goes away as soon as we kick the project off. And so from my client's perspective, that's a sunk cost. And then we work together and then we do the math at the end and figure out how much of an improvement there is. And then the result fee that I charge is based on also how much of the improvement there is. But the service fee is specifically designed as a sort of, I think you could call it a commitment device, or colloquialist, it's skin in the game. And so the idea is that if I worked exclusively on spec, if I only had a result fee and no service fee, you come to work with me, you pay me nothing, we work together, and then you give me a cut of what you negotiate. That sounds great to most people. And a lot of people suggest that I do that. But the problem is that I know that I have no way to force people to do what I say on my own. And so if it's all spec, then I say, I want you to send this email. They look at it and they say, I'm not going to send that email. I have no recourse. Whereas I really have no recourse otherwise, except I can say, okay, well, you don't have to do what I say, but you hired me to do this thing for me. And also your service fee has been paid and it's non-refundable because we already started the project. So you should probably do what I say because I'm an expert and that's why you hired me. That's why we're here. And they do. And it's, yeah, you know, 100% hit rate. Whereas anytime that I kind of do something on spec, people, I have to, it's really, really difficult to get them to do the thing because it's hard and they don't have anything to lose by not doing the thing. So they can just give in to fear. There's no cost to that they can see. There's definitely a cost, but there's a cost. There's no cost to them explicitly in terms of a sunk cost of the service fee. And so they just sometimes will bail. The other side of that is also part of my job as a coach is to say, listen, I understand that you're scared of this and you should be, because by the way, every time that a client of mine sends a counteroffer email, I get nervous every time, 100%. It's 100% hit rate. I wish I could say that it doesn't bother me, but every time they do, I'm like, oh man, this is, whew. You know, I hope we get a good answer here. You know, I mean, it feels, yeah, it's nerve wracking. And I'm sure y'all do interview coaching and things like that. And you help people have difficult conversations with managers. And I know that you're like, I know they're having a conversation with Tina at 2 o'clock and man, I hope that thing goes well. Right.
Yeah.
It's a feeling where I am deeply invested in their outcomes as a person, but also, you know, financially, it's all interwoven for me and my business is built to instill that kind of concern in me so that I think very carefully about everything that I ask anyone to do, because I have skin in the game too. But I know, and the reason that I still have them send that email, I feel good about it and I'm not worried about them reneging the offer or anything bad happening, is one, I know my methodology works. I've got lots and lots of reps with it. I've worked with somewhere between 150 and 200 people one-on-one, and then thousands of people have read my book and used my book and courses and all that good stuff. And the sort of even just non-neutral, like negative story, a bad outcome is like just exceedingly rare. And when they work with me, it's basically null, like it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
And part of that is, I know the methodology backward and forward. I modify the methodology based on the person, their situation. So that's something, you know, we've already kind of talked about this, but when I'm talking to someone, I'm not just going to say, do this thing. And just like I listen very carefully to what they're doing and I modify small things and wording and tactics and approaches that we use and numbers. And a lot of stuff gets modified. That's very subtle. Even if you were observing me in every engagement, you may not recognize the subtle differences, but they're there in the way that I approach things. Also just the way that I communicate is, I call it positively persuasive or whatever. That's what I've been writing about lately, kind of talking about on a few different podcasts. But the idea is that I use positive language almost exclusively. So I will almost never use a negative word. And even there, the way that I phrase that, like it, there's a distinct contrast between the way I describe what I do and what I don't do. And they're very different, black and white. And so the way that I communicate with my clients and the way that they communicate with people that they're negotiating with is extremely collaborative. It's positive. They're working with them as an ally, as a partner. They're not using ultimatums. They're not making enemies. They're not drawing lines in the sand. And that is because I've been doing this for a very long time and because I'm just wired that way. So I get to combine those kind of two things into one thing, which is when I have a client send an email that's a counteroffer email, I'm 100% confident that it will be received well. Because yeah, to not receive it well would require almost some kind of like psychopathy or something. Like you would have to want to be offended by this email because it just says, hey, you know, you offered this. I'd be more comfortable if we could do this. Here's a description of the value that I add. I'm looking forward to hearing what you think. So, you know, that's a long answer to your question, but the specific is that I am very careful and cautious with the way that I communicate. And I have a specific way of implementing my methodology that is almost guaranteed to be unoffensive to anyone who's involved in the process, especially anyone who understands business in any meaningful way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been our experience too. And I would add that for our clients who were on the fence, on the ledge, however you want to phrase it, we coached them through it. They negotiated and they got what they asked for. In other words, they earned more than they would have if they didn't negotiate, if they just accepted the offer, like 100% of the time. And it's exactly because of, I think that the thing that for me and that I've noticed with a lot of our clients is, look, you're not being an asshole here. You are negotiating. It is a collaboration. It's not a, I love this language. It's not a line in the sand. It's not a, you know, you have to say yes to this or else kind of a thing. It really is a, here's what I would be more comfortable with given what I just described in terms of my value. So, and then I look forward to hearing back from you. And so it does require like a comfort in leaving things up in the air. Mm-hmm. I think for some people, it may actually feel more safe almost to just say, just tell me yes or no. Right. Versus yep. saying, here's your initial sort of offer. Here's my counter offer. And we're going to go back and forth. And for yep. a lot of people, it's just like, no. I just want to know. And that requires patience, that requires perspective, that does require some certainty, that does require professionalism that I know that the people that we work with have, because they are high earners or close to high earners. They couldn't have got there without that. But it's just such an interesting thing, especially the psychological piece of it. That's the part that we love. And that's like our sweet spot. So that's why it's so fun for us. So
a good deal yeah. of the faith that we're able to rely on once someone does get the offer comes from the fact that all of the events leading up to the informal, either by voice or by email or by text message, all of those events happen bing, bang, boom, exactly as predicted. And you can lay it out for them. This is going to happen. And then this is going to happen. And then this is going to happen. Now you're going to do this and they're going to do this. And then you do this. By the time that last conversation happens, they're like, we're in the pocket. Everything is rocking and rolling. We're moving straight ahead. Keep on keeping on. We got this.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the fun things that I found early on when I was doing this, is it felt like I had, you know, like a magic eight ball, or like I'm some kind of a wizard. And that's the way I'm perceived sometimes, even now, is they'll be like, the recruiter just called me and they said exactly what you said they were going to say. I was like, yes. And then what did you say? You know?
Yes.
And the reason is that what I did ultimately, and what I've done with my coaching, is I built a playbook, but the playbook is in response to another playbook. And that is the playbook that almost every company runs with hiring conversations. So all I did was essentially say, oh, there are patterns here. Like, it doesn't matter if I'm talking to Amazon, Google, or some small firm, you know, local marketing firm, they all do the same thing. There is a way that you make a job offer. There is a way that you respond to a counter offer, and recruiters have certain tendencies. And so all I do was just build a methodology to respond to those tendencies and to prepare for them. And it makes sense, right? Like if you're starting a company and you're hiring people, maybe one of the biggest ways that you could waste time is to create your very own unique hiring process. You would never do that. You just use whatever hiring process has been proven to work for the last 100 years in the way that we do things. And you just do that. And so my methodology is built to work within that hiring process. It is essentially universal. And so that's why it feels like magic to our clients when we're talking to them. But the reality is, we just happen to know that there's essentially one system that's copy pasted to every organization, and they use the same system regardless of how big it is. And the only wrinkle is, I call it the recruiter lottery, but there are some interesting recruiters that you'll run into who do weird stuff or say weird things or take exception to certain things. And frankly, it's because they're having a bad week or a bad day, or, yeah. you know, they have a headache or something like that. You can't really build a methodology around that. But in general, you know, the 97-98% of our interactions are going to look the same because they're all following the same playbook. So my playbook is just a response to their playbook.
We've yeah. been working with you since, so the last episode that Jen recorded with you of the People Stack podcast was episode number 45. That was in 2018.
Wow.
And
wow.
so it has wow. been, yeah, exactly. I know what you do. I have read your book cover to cover several times in preparation for helping to apply it. And I have seen the magic work. I'm still pretty convinced you're a wizard, Josh.
Well, maybe that'll be my next thing. I'll see if I can figure out how to wizard other things.
Yeah. Like, well, what I would say, if Josh is a wizard, then so are we. Yeah. Because we have a similar thing. Like, this is how you're going to upgrade your career. These Absolutely. Are the steps in general that you're going to go from, in order to go from, hell no, I hate this job, or I'm feeling bored, or whatever it is that doesn't feel good, to a place where you have your hell yes job. And negotiation yep. is one of those steps. And then with yep. negotiation, we get to break it down even further. And the other ones we break down even further too. So what I wanted to ask about, what came to mind, so this is sort of a, you know, I'm going to get a little spicy here and okay. throw a wrench in the works. So how do you feel about salary transparency? because that almost feels like a whole, maybe a nuclear bomb, but maybe in a good way, to this whole, there is this process that we've been following for hundreds of years. Now throw in salary transparency, where it might look like in the job ad, there's a range, or, you know, something else like that. They may just be, you know, you apply and then the recruiter right out says, okay, this is what we're looking to pay. So how do you feel about that? And how does that change your approach, if at all?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I've been thinking about this for a few years, I would say. It was probably 3 or 4 years ago that there started to be, like, individual states started passing laws that you, for example, couldn't ask for salary history. And so that's not salary transparency the way you're describing it, but it's of a kind, right? They're related. And the idea is that if we get this information out there, then I want to be very careful here. I don't want to misrepresent the case for salary transparency, but that it will help protect workers from being exploited in some way, and that they'll get their paid their due because there won't be this kind of what's perceived as sort of a backroom dealing aspect to compensation offer and planning. I come out pretty ambivalent on it. And here's why: is that ultimately employment is a market, and markets essentially are just prices being communicated to respond to supply and demand. And so the result is that every person brings a different quality of work to what they do, and a different skill set, a different skill stack. And so, you know, for example, even like software engineers, like I think for a lot of people, they perceive like a software engineer, let's say like an L4 at Google, which is like pretty entry level newish software engineer, that they're fungible, that if you took 5,000 of them and you lined them up, they would all be exactly the same. And you could just plug one in here and plug one in there, but that's just not true. Because when Google hires that person, they're hiring them to do a specific project, and that project has certain needs, and that person has certain needs that either align well or don't align well with it. And so where I'm going is, what has happened, as far as I have seen, and there's a lot of companies that are doing this quote unquote kind of salary transparency stuff now, is they're posting, you know, so one of the things is like you post the pay range and the job description. And so the problem is that if you look at these job descriptions and pay ranges, it's not, the pay range is $250,000 to $260,000 base comp. It's, the pay range is $150,000 to $320,000, depending on geography, which is not a pay range. It's just two big numbers, right?
So numbers out there.
Even in the implementation of it, they have to acknowledge that we actually don't know what we're going to pay this person. And so for me, if somebody comes to me and says, well, the pay range posted is $150,000 to $320,000, I say, okay, whatever. Like, what did they offer you? That's what I care about. So do they offer you $160,000? Do they offer you $310,000? And then we'll see where is the opportunity to improve the offer. So it doesn't impact me, especially because a lot of this stuff is like, you can actually get more, this is weird, but the company will tell you a range, and you could just go to a lot of different salary websites. Levels is a big one for software engineering and tech, levels.fyi. But you'll get more specific data points there than you would from the actual job description that you're actually applying to. So maybe the short answer is, it has not at all affected the way that I do my job. And I have not yet been able to perceive any difference that I get in the results for my clients when we are negotiating. I think there may be good reasons for it, and it might save some people some time in some cases, but I think the sort of promise so far, this promise of salary transparency, has not been realized. And I think the reason is, it's very difficult to do that because everybody is different. They live in different places. They have different years of experience. They have different subtle things on their resume that other people don't have, or they have experience that other people haven't gotten. And that makes them bring a different level of value to the role than somebody else who, like I said, might be perceived as fungible from the outside, but in reality is not fungible with one person to another. So there you go. Yeah. I don't know how that lands, but those are my thoughts on salary transparency.
Yeah, I think that it shows an appreciation for the nuance of this, and also that we're in the very early stages of salary transparency as well. Yep.
Yeah, the widest range I saw was for a Netflix role, and the beginning of the range was 300,000. This was for a director level or a senior manager level. Yep. And then the top end of the range was 900,000.
There you go.
So we're talking a spread of $600,000. And just that spread, like for many people in the country, that's just like, holy crap, that's life-changing, game-changing, world-changing. So yeah, as I looked into this actually before we started our conversation. There's 29 states and District of Columbia have bans on asking about salary history, which is huge. And most people don't quite grok how huge that is. Mm-hmm. Only 8 states have requirements around posting salary range. But in the world of work from home, those 3 of those 8 states constitute enough of the hiring market for at least software folk that everybody now has to do it. Mm-hmm. We were talking Colorado, California, and New York.
Yeah.
Which is
3 big markets. Yep.
Massive markets for software. Now, yep. When it comes to the salary history, can you talk a bit about the impact of banning your salary history from being part of what's considered for your new compensation, please?
Yeah. So this is interesting to me because one of the first things, I mean, it's in my book. So I wrote the book at the end of 2015. Which sounds like a long time ago, but also every now and then I pick it up and read it and go, this is pretty good. Like there's a reason I haven't written a second edition of the book yet. In the chapter 3, How to Ace Your Next Interview, I talk about what I call in the book, the dreaded salary question, which is the two-parter is what's your current salary, your salary history, and what's your expected salary? What do you want to make? And so in the book, I say, don't answer that. Do not tell them your salary history. And to be honest with you, those laws just make my life easier because if you have shared your salary history, and I'll talk about why, it can definitely make it more difficult to negotiate. And so if somebody has shared salary history or their current salary is usually the most common component of salary history that they share, it just makes it more difficult to negotiate. And so that gives me a thing that I have to kind of unwind in the process. Or work around. If I don't unwind it, or ignore it. And so it just makes things a little bit trickier. It doesn't necessarily mean like, oh, we're dead in the water. We can't negotiate. It means, oh, okay, there's another step or two that we have to go through. So I think banning it is fine and good. All of my clients for years have not been sharing that information anyway. People who do share it, I think there is an opportunity to kind of, like I said, unwind that. The reason I don't like it from my perspective as a coach, and then I can talk economically about it too, but as a coach, I don't like it. I don't use jargon a lot, but I have to here. I can't think of any way around it, but you know, it's an anchor, right? So in negotiation, there's anchoring, which is, you know, the first number that somebody says is a meaningful number that will probably kind of be almost like a center of gravity for future numbers that are set in the negotiation. Like that first number, the anchor, just kind of pulls all the other numbers towards it. And I want to avoid anchors. And the main reason is because I don't think most of the time that my clients have enough information, even with things like levels and salary transparency, to set the anchor in the optimal place. They're going to put it in the wrong place and it's going to cost them money or could cost them an opportunity, right? If they drop the anchor way above the top of the range, the company might just shut down and stop talking to them. If they drop the anchor too low, then it could draw their pay lower to that anchor and cost them money. Sometimes in a weird way that they may not even know it. They may actually think they got a win when they got a loss there. So that's why, from my perspective, I don't like to share it because I want the company to reveal their number first. And the reason is, let's say there are 1,000 data points available in a salary negotiation. The company has like 850 of those and my client has 150, probably fewer. And we just have a huge information gap. And one of the biggest pieces of information essentially boils down to what is your budget? What are you willing to pay this person to do this role approximately? And you don't get that if you've set an anchor first, because then what you get is a response to the anchor and not a response to what their perceived budget is or how badly they want to hire the person. And that's the information that you need. So part of the reason that I say don't go first is that it keeps the deck clear essentially for them to make an offer. But part of the reason also is we're trying to get as much information as we can. So at least we can go from they have 850 and we have 150 data points to, well, now we have 151 because they told us what their kind of allotted number is from. So that's why I think it's bad for clients from the business perspective. I don't like it because it, the reason that it happens, the reason that companies do it is really twofold. One is, I think, to save money, but two is because it's kind of lazy. It's a quick and dirty algorithm that they can run to get to a number that you might be happy with. And so you tell them your current salary, they add 5 or 10% and bingo, bango, they got a good job offer to spit out to you. They don't have to do the work of figuring out what the value is that you bring to the role. And so that's part of the uncomfortable nature of this moment that comes for people when they're asked this question, is that they sense that the recruiter wants this information from them pretty badly. And they sense that the recruiter is a gatekeeper who can keep the process from moving forward as long as they're unhappy. And so they think, I have to assuage this recruiter. I will give them the current salary number. Then I will get a fair offer. But the reality is that by taking that shortcut, getting out of the uncomfortable moment, they're probably dropping an anchor in a place that is not optimal for them. Almost certainly, like 99.999% of the time, they're going to drop the anchor in the wrong place. So from the company side, I think I understand it. And it's just a kind of a lazy way to not have to figure out what this offer needs to look like to persuade this person to join my team. And instead is, I'll just give them a number that's bigger than the one they already said, and maybe they'll just take it.
Yeah.
Can we talk more about if they were not being lazy? So I've heard, both in lived experience and in anecdata, which is a collection of anecdotes, of course, when folks go to an outside consultancy, like say they bought data from Radford, my experience is that Radford's going to give you whatever data you ask for. And if you say, I want to focus on this city with this focus and these other metrics, that's the data they're going to give you. That's going to shape how you build your salary bands. What would be the better approach in your esteem?
I think that is not necessarily a bad way to go about it. You have to, I mean, the truth is, I think most companies are doing that, right? So what you just described is a big reason that I don't negotiate based on market data. So you notice I've said 100 times the word value. My negotiation strategy is value-based. I'm looking at the value of the particular individual to the particular organization and the particular role. That little triumvirate works together. The problem with a market-based negotiation is that you might, you know, if I'm talking to Google and I say, hey, you offer me $100,000, I'd be more comfortable $110,000 because I have some market data. Then they're going to say, we offered you $100,000 because we have millions of data points from the market. And we know that $100,000 is the right number, your move. And now you're kind of stuck because you went to battle with somebody who has on a data basis where they have more data. I do think building pay bands, especially for bigger organizations, right? Building pay bands is really hard. Like if you have a really small organization, just a few headcount, and you're hiring somebody, a lot of your hiring decision, your budget is going to be based on like literally what can you afford to pay that person and not on what's the average pay band for this type of job. And this, you're going to hire somebody who like buys into your vision, and there are reasons they will work for you that may not necessarily be like market-based reasons. But if you have a giant organization, you've got to, especially if you're building out a new org or you're hiring a new type of person, like you have to start somewhere. And it would be silly, I think, to be like, I don't know, we need this type of person in our accounting department. We've never hired them before. What's a fair wage? $50,000? I don't know. Like just to throw something at the wall and see what sticks. And so there, I think it is very wise. If you're going to build pay bands from scratch, you should get data and say, what are these people making in this metro area and what can we pay them? And then from there, of course, you can change it based on your profitability and some other stuff. So, I think what you described is a process that a smart company should be doing when they're building pay bands to start. I also think then that there is a lot of, first of all, if you look at pay bands, they overlap significantly. So even that is a tell that this isn't really a science so much if it's a range finding mission. And I think then that data can be used. And from my perspective is that, okay, that's a starting point. There are three pay bands that overlap at this number that you offered. I want to push into one of these top two pay bands or this top one pay band. That's essentially what we're communicating without saying out loud.
And I believe the savvy HR professional knows that it's more art than science.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe that simultaneously, the people who are demanding that HR go ahead and do this are hoping for a science that absolves them of further investigation, further work, and make sure that they're paying something fair. I don't have further to go with that point. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I mean, I think the reason like that you ended there is that it's a sticky wicket, right? Like it's very difficult to kind of navigate. But I think at the end of the day, I mean, even in my book, there's a, in chapter 2, I think it is, there's a pay band diagram, right? And they overlap. And they can be very wide. And a lot of times, you know, two pay Microsoft L64 and 63 are the same pay band, but one is for basically internal promotions and one's for external hires. And they do that for reasons that have nothing to do with pay. Right. So it's like that example, I think, illustrates that pay bands in and of themselves are used for a lot more things than figuring out like what's the right pay for this person. And levels also, right? Like it's much more prestigious to say I'm a level 7 or level 7.5 at Google, right? And that's like, if you know, wink, wink, right? And there's a lot of value in that too. So there's a lot of signaling that's going on. There's much more to pay bands than just like a scientific approach to what do we pay this person? There's a much more, like that's one factor of, you know, 25 factors that go into pay bands and putting people into pay bands and all that good stuff.
Is there a more scientific way? Could there be a generic right answer?
I think the answer is no. I'm going purely on it. I've never thought about this before, but I mentioned earlier markets, right? Mm-hmm. Here's what I tell people is even if I had, you know, for your job at your company, if I had the pay bands in front of me right now that are set, those were set sometime in the past and they're going to change. So even if I had them, they're not that useful to me. What matters to me is what is the offer that you got? That's the number that matters, right? Because over time, the reason is prices change, inflation happens. You get 9% inflation for a year, and all of those old pay bands are totally meaningless. They have to do something with them. Or the stock price tanks. You have to do something about that, or you're going to lose half your workforce. So when they're equity-based compensation, that's, you know, especially I'm thinking of Amazon here, where it's like you've got a huge cliff of people who are going to invest 40% of their equity and the equity lost 50% since that happened. They have to do something. And so anyway, the reason there's not a pure science answer is whatever the numbers are today, they're going to change tomorrow. And there's not an equation that can, if there was an equation, so here's my answer. If there was a scientific way to do this accurately, I would not be talking to you right now because I would be killing it investing in markets, just killing it, because that would be the answer, right? Is, oh, I had this algorithm solved. I know if I know what the optimal and perfect scientific prices to pay this particular employee at this particular company, I have solved the economy. And that means that I shouldn't be doing like what we're doing right now would not be the optimal use of any of our time. We should be off doing other things with that information. So no, prices change, markets change. Even let's say that there was a specific price that mattered, but a company needs 100 of those people and there are only 150 of them globally. They have to pay more to get 100 of those 150 people. The pay band no longer matters. So it just breaks down under any kind of price mechanism that shows up.
Yeah.
I have one more follow-up. Sorry. I know you're itching, Jen.
Go for it.
One of the starting things that folks tend to want to do or are advised to do is to understand what the value of their role is and the value that they give. Now, you can go to levels.fyi, you can look up what some of these larger organizations are paying, and that's much better than, say, going to Glassdoor or salary.com or some of these other folks that are basically, you're either disgruntled or extremely happy in order to post there. Mm-hmm. What's your advice for people who need to level set their own expectations and come up with what they believe their value is so that they have that number in their head? They have that value.
Yeah. So I call this a market value estimate. So as much as I sort of poo-pooed market data earlier, it is a useful tool, especially for this problem. So I like to start broad. So those resources that you mentioned are pretty good, right? One thing that you always have to keep in mind, even with something like Levels, I think Levels is a very reliable source. The other ones are reliable to an extent, but like you said, that there's selection bias there, right? Who is posting their numbers here and reviews? But you have to start somewhere. It is important to remember that they're always going to be lagging indicators, right? So whatever the average is for the last 100 people who posted on Levels for a particular role, I mean, that's over several months, right? So you're looking at data that has aged. So you have to keep that in mind. But I think that it's still pretty reliable data. I mean, it's self-reported. There's a lot of reasons that you would say, well, I'm not going to write a scientific paper using that data, but it's good enough, I think. So you start with a really broad look. Usually I go kind of like in a global geography, like a region. So like North America, for example, or the US. So you say, all right, well, in the US, somebody with this job on these three different sites, is making this much, this much, this much. You average them together. Now you have a kind of a rough estimate to like what the comp should be for that person in that role, right? And then what I like to do is kind of narrow it down even more geographically. So if you're going to be working in California, that's a lot different than if you're working in Iowa, if you can, or if you're working remotely, figure out what remote comp is. And you kind of go from like this really broad number and you kind of start to narrow it down. So you use like market data for the US, market data for a region, market data for a region for an industry, and get smaller. And then eventually, if you can, try to get data from within that company, which you can do. So Levels, Team Blind is a great place to do this. I love Blind. It's actually people who are saying like, this is my offer. This is what happened when I negotiated. Also, I don't have access to it. I wouldn't want access to it, but there's, for example, a magic spreadsheet that floats around Google with a lot of people putting their comp in there. And if you happen to know somebody who works at Google and you can ask them to take a look at the magic spreadsheet, they can tell you very precisely what comp looks like for the role that you're looking at. And so the point being that you're going to get some data set. And it could be as specific as at the company you're going to, what are they paying those people? You could also just ask somebody if you bump into them at a conference, like, hey, I like to do it in a hypothetical sense. So like, hey, if y'all were to hire somebody with your profile, I know you're a senior engineer that's working at this tech company. If you were to hire another one of you on your team, like, what do you think that person would start at? And so you're saying, hey, what are you making? But you don't ask that, you don't have to cross the cultural taboo, and they're not, they're like, oh, and they say they basically tell you their salary, or give or take. So you get the more specific information last, but you start with the market and then, you know, geography and then industry and then company, if you can, and even specific role within company. And now you have a data set that you can kind of triangulate on what's a reasonable level of comp that I can expect if I get a job offer from that company or in that industry, in that geography. And that's your starting point. Also, you ask like how they decide like what they need to be make. So I call this your minimum acceptable salary. It's like, what's the minimum number? This is a line in the sand, but it's not used in the negotiation unless the negotiation has just not gotten you to this number and you're going to say no. I'm going to say no unless is how that comes out. So you're saying, okay, well, what do I need to make to do this? And a lot of that is, okay, well, now I know market stuff, but it may be important to me whether I have to commute or what the company is doing. And so now you get into other kind of squishier stuff that helps you to move that number up or down, right? So you might say, well, yes, they're offering $100,000, but I would give my left arm to work for this company. I really don't care what it is. So you don't, maybe you don't have a minimum. Or yeah, they're offering $100,000, but I have to make a commute. And to be honest with you, like, I'm not super excited about this role. And so I'm going to need at least 115, or I probably am just going to keep looking. I'd rather stay put and keep looking, right? And so there's, it becomes very subjective, and this is the art and science kind of colliding. So that's my answer to your question. You start with actual market data, and then you're going to fudge that number based on your own personal preferences, and you're going to push it up or down into a number that you call, that's my minimum. If they give me this or more, I'm going to go there. And I would say probably 70% of the time, the offer that most people get meets or exceeds the minimum anyway, so it almost doesn't even come to play. But it's good to have that number in mind in case it doesn't, because that will inform your negotiation strategy after you get the offer.
Yeah, I think that's so useful, and we've used that, like you said, it's in your book, and we've used that in coaching our clients too. So I wanted to share one more thing about pay bands, because there's just so much to say about pay bands, but I do want to move on from that. But just before, like, just to give, this is actually my personal experience with pay bands. It's not in SAC, it's in academics. But I think it goes to show, really, I think the art and science of it, right? That the human factor in this, that yes, there may be a science, there's data involved in it. And then you have to consider that there's humans involved in it as well. When I first got an offer for my very first academic job, there was a union and there were pay bands. There were very specific pay bands. And so I tried my best to negotiate. I think I did a pretty good job negotiating, but what I kept getting back was, no, I'm sorry. I love that you're negotiating. We really can't go above this number because of the union negotiated pay bands. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of poked into it a little bit. What I was able to negotiate were what's known as startup costs. So in other words, I got some more to start my lab and to start my research lab. So that felt good. That felt like a win, and it was great. And then I come to find out, so we were hiring someone else like a few years later, and I was part of the hiring committee. We found out that actually, and I don't know if things had changed, you know, I'm going to be fair here. I'm not saying that anybody screwed me over. Not that at all. But come to find out that someone that was hired, she basically negotiated exactly what you were talking about, which was like, okay, well, what's the next pay band? Mm-hmm. I feel that I deserve to be not considered in this first time professor pay band, but the one above that. And it's for these reasons. And maybe I didn't have enough. It was my literal first job, and maybe it wasn't her first job. But it just goes to show you that, like, even if they say, no, this is the pay band. Okay, well, what's the next one? And then, and she actually got more than most of us got when we first started. And I only knew this because I was part of the hiring committee. So I was like, damn it, but okay, good, you go. Like, yep. That's the human piece of it, where it's like, yeah, there actually is some wiggle room, even if they keep telling you no. So I think that's a really important lesson to learn.
And yeah, I just want to underscore Jen's response to finding out somebody came in and negotiated more than she did wasn't, I'm going to tear you down.
A little bit.
It was, yeah, you go. Make it easier for the next person. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
I just wanted to underscore that. I'm sorry. Carry on.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree with that, by the way. I mean, I think that's how most people feel. I think you can't help but feel that you missed out on something, right? That you got slighted, or like, you can't help but feel that. But you also can be like, hey, nice work. You know, I hope the next person who comes, you know, it's nice to see that maybe this is being corrected, that they're finding a better way to do this. That is a thing that I didn't write about it in my book because it's such a subtle thing. But when I'm coaching people, I will ask them questions, and what I'm trying to tease out of them is there an opportunity to try and up level? And so sometimes we'll be asking, you know, another thing that I say a lot to my clients is, if I could see the top of the pay band that they're offering you, I would ask for more. I want to ask for above the top of the pay band because I want to continue getting stuff for you, including the top of the pay band, but I want other stuff too. Not a lot more, but I would overshoot it. The conversation sometimes will be, we're counter offering. We're going to be offering what we think might be either at the top of or above the top of the pay band. And in the interview process, you actually were talking about L5 or L6. Like, it came up a couple of times and it seems like they're kind of on the fence. And so what we'll do is I like to let the numbers drive this. First we ask for more money, and then we'll say, by the way, I understand that the amount I asked for might require a higher pay band. And if that's true, I'm open to having that discussion. And so it's a weird way of phrasing it, but it's basically saying, look, I know that I'm probably asking for something in a higher pay band, and it would be great if you just go ahead and give me the higher pay. Like, I'm open to that, right? And so now they have to come back and they almost have to give you like a double objection. So hopefully they'll give you one of those, right? But that's a subtle thing that I will tease out when I'm talking to people to figure out, is this an angle that we can take? But it also will help to soften, even if they come back and say, well, we can't level you up, but here's what we could do on comp, and maybe we can still push that pay band. So yes. They're, and like I said, they overlap a lot too, right? So the top of one pay band may be below the middle of the next pay band up. And so if you can get leveled up, sometimes it's a huge benefit, even at the same comp, because you go from really pushing up against the edge of the top pay band, which could restrict you in raises and promotions and things like that in the short term, to the bottom of the higher pay band, where you have all this room ahead of you in terms of raises. So that can be a big win if you can get just leveled up in pay band, even if it doesn't actually short-term change your comp, it could long-term change your comp possibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you're positioning yourself for your next promotion already. Yep. And making it easier for people to just do it because you're in the correct box, right? We don't have to change the box. Although changing boxes happens all the time. Changing pay bands happens all the time. And often that's a required part of any promotion conversation as well. So I think that's an important point, especially for our clients. So I'm glad we dug into that a little bit.
Yeah.
So changing topics and actually going back to your career trajectory, Josh, it feels like this is your dream career. Yeah, it feels like this is like, yeah, I really enjoy doing this. I love geeking out about it. I've really found my sweet spot. That's what I get from hearing you talk about it. Does it feel like your dream career to you?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it's interesting because I have lots of thoughts on this, but the main thing is that I'm naturally like pretty introverted. So like right now I'm kind of performing like extrovert podcast guest, but as soon as we're done talking, I'm just going to totally crash. Right. And so when I look at my calendar and I have calls on my calendar, my first thought is, ugh, calls. And so unfortunately I have built a business that requires calls to be on my calendar. But the really funny thing is every time, 100% of the time, I get on the phone with that person and immediately am energized and like, this is awesome. And especially when, you know, they're telling me like, oh, I hadn't thought of that, or this is great, I feel good about it. That's super encouraging to me. And like I said, the outcomes that I'm able to help people get, which I know they would have not have gotten on their own, are just really gratifying and edifying for me. And so, yeah, I mean, I love what I do. Like I said earlier, if I won the Mega Millions, I think I probably would just keep doing this. I don't know. I would, the thing about me is I would be doing this regardless of whether it was my career. I was already doing this before I wrote the book. The reason I wrote the book was not to start the business. It's because the next logical thing for me to do is just write the book so I could tell more people about it. Cause I was already helping people negotiate stuff and helping with career choices. So, yeah, I think it is my dream job. My dream career, which I kind of just managed to create for myself. It's gratifying. I like to do it. It can be challenging sometimes in terms of, you know, kind of fighting my introvert, extrovert, where I'm on that spectrum, but I do love it and I enjoy what I do.
That's awesome. Looking back, because hindsight is always 2020, you know, even for the clients who work with us, where we definitely add a good dose of intentionality in creating your dream career, there's always some, call it what you want, like luck or, you know, fortune smiling upon you, the things that you can't control. There's always an element of both. But for you, like looking back, what would you say were the key components that you did, that you had control over, like in terms of the internal work that you did in order to set yourself up for this success?
So I skipped over a lot. I know that earlier we started with, you know, what's the path that led me to salary negotiation coach as a career. I skipped over a bunch of stuff. And part of that was me kind of realizing several things, but realizing that I was not a very good employee. I did not like having a manager. I did not like having other people dictating what I did or what I worked on. And I really didn't like that I felt like I was creating a lot of value for organizations, but was not capturing but a tiny sliver of that value. It really bothered me. And so a couple of things. One is I made a plan. So I started this business in, let's say, 2016. In 2012, I started making the plan that would allow me to start the business. And that started with, okay, well, I need to pay off, you know, I have MBA loans that I took out to get my MBA. Those got to be paid off. And then I got to pay off this other thing that I have. And then I need to put some money in the bank. And I need to start building a runway so I have cash on hand. I also need to figure out like what I'm going to do. So I did not set out to be a salary negotiation coach. I kind of settled on, I was going to build a software company, and I did essentially build the software company, but it was one of those things where I had this plan that started in 2012, and I can vividly remember because it was my friend James and I were out playing Frisbee golf, and I was like, here's what I'm going to do. And I laid it out for him. He was like, all right, that sounds great. And then like 5 or 6 years later, when I had done it and I had started the business, it was like, wow, that's what I did. So part of it was planning for it, right? Like it didn't just happen to me. Part of what I'm doing did just sort of happen to me. I told you earlier how I got into coaching kind of accidentally. But the idea of, I'm not going to have a day job. I'm going to save up money. I'm going to build my own business. And I just got to figure out what that business is, which is a big black box to deal with. But that was the plan, was part of it. So, you know, I intentionally built that. I also had an epiphany at my last day job. It was like a year into it. And I was managing a team, and everybody on my team had gotten a substantial raise, and most of them had gotten promotions. And I realized I'd been there for a year, and it hadn't occurred to me to try to get more money for myself. And I said, aha. So that seems like a tell that the money that I'm making is fine. I can live off of it. I don't feel like I need more of it. I'm not lacking for anything. And then the next epiphany was, well, I mean, I was making okay money, but I wasn't making a lot of money. And I was like, if that's all I need to survive and be comfortable, I think I can do that on my own. Like, I think I can build a business to generate that kind of money, and maybe sooner than I thought. And so those were the two things that I think I did intentionally, was planned for it, saved up money, paid off debt, got really lean. Even to this day, my only debt is a mortgage. And then I think I owe like $3,000 on my car, like 1% or something like that. You know what I mean? But that's it. And I keep it lean like that because I need to be able to get through lean times. And I want to make sure that I'm set up to long-term do this. And that plan started, you know, 11 years ago in 2012 is when I actually started making that plan in earnest. So,
awesome.
Yeah. So those are the things that I think I've done is plan very carefully how to do the financial aspects of it. And then also just had the epiphany that, oh, the amount of money that I need to make, I don't need to make $1 million a year to be okay. Like it's much, much less than that. And I think I could probably do that. Let's find out.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually the next question I wanted to ask was about financial freedom. My guess is that that idea comes up a lot in talking with your clients. It certainly does with ours. What's financial freedom to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think financial freedom is just not having to worry about the basics. Like I said, paying the mortgage, living month to month, being able to just kind of do what I want when I want. I have very sort of simple taste, right? So I don't need to drive like a $300,000 car or anything crazy like that. Like I don't need to go to Cabo once a month. So just being able to kind of do what I want to do. And I think ultimately the tell for me, so I went through a pretty lean time kind of coming out of it now, but starting last year, because big tech basically went into a recession and my whole market was big tech people. They stopped hiring and started laying everyone off. So my business got really lean. And the thing, honestly, that it's very financially stressful to go through that. But the thing that bothered me the most was that I had to stop being generous when I wanted to be generous. So, you know, if I knew somebody who needed a thing, and normally in the past, I'd have been like, you know what, here, like get the thing. And I'm not talking like, you know, huge amounts of money, but just being able to do it and be like, here's $100. Or like, you know, I remember my mom had a problem with like a roof and it was like $2,000. And I was like, here, mom, here, just don't worry about it. Just I'll get it. Right. You raised me. You did a lot of great things for me, including creating me. So here, I haven't been able to do that very much over the last 8 months. And that makes me feel not financially free. So for me, that's kind of the bellwether. That's the harbinger. That's the canary in the coal mine, is do I feel like I can be generous when I see opportunities for generosity, or am I hamstrung and I'm just trying to survive? So actually I think I would go back to everything I said and say, that's for me, that's financial freedom, is that if I see a need and an opportunity to help someone, that I feel comfortable just doing the thing and helping them and not losing sleep over it. That's where
I love this so much, because people often talk about the idea of FU money. Like when I have FU money, that's how I know that I'm financially free. And what you just turn it on its head. It's basically like when I have love you money, love you, mom, here's money for the roof. Love you, man. Here's this thing for your birthday that I know that you've been wanting. That when you're able to do that and share generously, I know that I can absolutely relate to that as well. We've done some really that have felt really good, just this wonderful things for our family, like taking them on a trip to Italy and staying in the North Shore of Oahu, not last Christmas, the Christmas before, and we paid for a big chunk of it. And it just feels so wonderful, especially when it's received and they're like, thank you, this is amazing. And then they're like, we're gonna pay for, you know, breakfast and lunch and dinner and whatever, because you guys covered that. It's just such a fun way to play with money. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with you that you know, for me too, is a big piece of it. It's what Rob and I love to do.
Yeah, it was really interesting to kind of go through that lean time and realize, yeah, I'm stressed because I got to pay the bills, but the thing that really stuck in my craw was that I couldn't do that stuff. Like I had to pull back the reins on, you know, I would see somebody who had a need that in the past I'd have been like, let me take care of that for you. And I couldn't do it. And it really bothered me, like a lot more than like the other kind of a life quality downgrades that people might experience. Or, you know, like I said, like I haven't been on a vacation this year. I went skiing earlier this year, but only because I prepaid for it last year. I don't care. I really don't care. Like I'm fine. I love being in my house. I love being here, hanging out in Gainesville. I just love it. But not being able to do the things that I see around me where it's like that person needs something and I would really like to just be able to give them that thing. That's the stuff that makes me think about, like, is the business going well enough? Do I need to like cut out some spending somewhere else? That's how I think about finances, I think.
Yeah. I have one more question that just came to mind, and then we'll check in and see if there's anything else that the rest of us want to talk about. What I want to ask, and I'll ask it, but then I want to frame it as well, is what are your money beliefs? Because we do very similar things. And I've noticed that I've gone on this journey as an entrepreneur. You know, ask any entrepreneur, they're going to have this journey, this shifting around what money means and do I need it and do I not? And everybody, it's going to be different for everyone. And especially doing what we do and doing what you do, that's so like transparently money focused. I got to take a wild guess and say that you've had a fun journey, some fun shifts, some fun aha moments, or even like revelatory, like, wow, I used to see money this way and now I see it that way kind of things. So what are your money beliefs and how have they changed?
Wow. I don't know if I've actually thought about this before, so it might take me a minute to come up with a good answer. I think above all, so I think there's, I think the core for that for me is that I would guess that if you asked a bunch of different people, like, what is money, you would get a very interesting variety of answers. For me, money is a tool to, first of all, survive, but also to do stuff with. And I think that may sound like people are listening like, yeah, duh. But what if I said, to me, money is a way to signal my authority or my power. Those are very different things. I don't believe that. That's not true for me. But I think a lot of people do think that. And in fact, I mean, that's where you get, you know, Instagram influencers on their jets and stuff like that. And it turns out it's not a real jet, right? And it's because they're trying to send that signal that they're powerful because they perceive money to be a marker of power. I couldn't care less if anyone knows how much I make or how well off I am or how poor I am. I grew up lower middle class, which is being kind of generous. There were times when, you know, I would visit my dad on the weekends and I was sleeping in his office because that was where his money went every month, was to rent the office for his business. He didn't have a house, right? And so I come from a socioeconomic background where, like I said, the epiphany that I had at that job that I had is I don't need a whole lot. If anything, it's been very difficult for me to spend money on things to kind of upgrade my life. I moved into this house a year ago. I love it here. It's a huge upgrade over my old house. And it took me a long time to kind of talk myself into spending money in that way because I was concerned that people would perceive that I was trying to send a signal about my own status with the house that I lived in, when in fact, I cared not at all about that and was frankly a little bit embarrassed when I moved into the house. And I kind of didn't want people to know, if that makes sense. So for me, my money beliefs are the best use of money is to be helpful and to create value. So I'm very active in my church. I give generously to my church when I can. I give generously to my friends and family when I can. And for me, like I said, if I won Mega Millions, I would be writing checks. I would spend most of my time writing checks, not to myself, but to people I know, because I'd be like, I hit the lotto. You get this and you get this and you get this. And it would be for things that I think people need and that would truly benefit them, right? So it's not just wasting money, but it would be things like, this is a thing that I know will benefit you. So I think my money belief is that money is simply a tool to accomplish things. And the things that I want to accomplish are hopefully to enrich other people's lives, maybe to make them more comfortable or to put a smile on their face or do something. I have two books here on my desk. I have some friends who were expecting. And so I have a book that I buy for my friends when they're expecting. It's called Expecting Better. But I just kind of do that because it's like, I think this will make your life better. I think if you read this book, it will make you feel better and you'll learn more. My money belief is it's a tool to enrich my life, but mostly to enrich others' lives around me and to be generous when I can.
Love it. Love it. Awesome. Rob, anything else you want to ask?
No, I think I'm good.
Awesome. Josh, anything else you want to share?
I don't think so. I think this is great. This is a lot of fun. I love the free-flowing conversation. You guys ask really good questions. And I think we've talked on some really interesting stuff that I get to talk about a lot and some things that I never get to talk about. So I think this is a lot of fun. I appreciate you having me on.
I agree. Yeah, it's been fun. We appreciate you taking the time. So I feel like it's a podcast, so I'm required to ask this. And also I want to ask this as well. Where can people follow you? How can people find you?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn, Josh Doody, super easy to find, Doody. I'm on Twitter at Josh Doody. The last name Doody is kind of a life hack for getting all the stuff with your name on it and dominating Google. And also fearlesssalarynegotiation.com. So LinkedIn, Twitter, and fearlesssalarynegotiation.com are all the best places to check me out.
Perfect.
And you can feel rest assured buying Josh's book. That version 2 is not anywhere near on the horizon. So you're getting the latest and greatest.
Yeah, 100%. There's not a new edition in the works at all.
Yes. Yeah. I can attest to that. I read it recently. It's like, yeah, this is spot on. So, all right, Josh, appreciate you. This has been really, really fun. It's been a pleasure having you on. Let's keep in touch.
Yeah. Same. Thanks for having me. This is a great conversation.
Awesome. And let's do it again sometime. Excellent.
Oh yeah.
How about it?
Bye for now.
And that wraps up another episode of the People Stack podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero. And it is such a fun ride, finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs, aloha, and mahalo.